some of us we have not met. So my name, I have to just think twice when I say it. I just recently underwent a spiritual initiation, another initiation in my progression. As a monk, my name is Keshava Swami. And I've been a kind of resident monk at our Hare Krishna temple in Watford, I guess, since the early 2000s. Like over 20 years. And I guess when I was 15 or 16, I had a spiritual calling and was looking into different traditions and looking for some answers to the bigger questions of life. And after university, I studied in London. I studied computer science and management. I went to India for some time, and then I became a monk when I was 21. My plan was not to live my whole life as a monk. But somehow or other, as they say, one thing led to another. And after spending 6 months in the monastery we have, I kind of found that this was my calling, my path in life, and so I continued on and continue on even today, learning every single day. I don't sit in front of you as someone who knows it all, someone who has all the answers, someone who's seen the light, but I can say that over the years I've met many amazing personalities, have had the opportunity to study a lot of amazing wisdom, and by the grace of Providence I've also had the opportunity to experience many things. And so when we come here, we come in a mood of sharing, to share with you and also to learn from you. So I hope that's what we'll do today. I think today our topic will be exciting and enlivening for you. And I'll just introduce my partner in crime today. So this is Nritya Shekhar Prabhu. Nritya Shekhar is a very nice name. It means the king of dancers, and Das means the servant. So he's the servant of the king of dancers, and he's a pretty good dancer himself as well. You may find out later on. And he also recently underwent a spiritual initiation. Previously, in his previous incarnation, he was Ian Nene, and a celebrity. Actually, he's a celebrity. As a child, as a young person in Kenya, he was actually like a social media guru. You can check him out if you don't believe me. On TV shows and other things, and he had his spiritual calling, and a few years ago he came to stay with us at the temple as well. And nowadays he doesn't live as a monk, he lives, but he's still connected very much to the temple and to the activities of trying to share this knowledge with the world in a relevant and inspiring way. So you can give him a So some of you are here for the first time, some of you have been coming for some time, but today is very, very informal. And what we're going to do today is we're going to have a little bit of a debate. Because sometimes when you come to these programs, there may be many questions in your minds, there may be many many things you're not sure about, or many things that people may ask you that you don't know how to answer that. And so what we're going to do today is have a little bit of a debate. Here in the Krishna Consciousness Movement, perhaps our most important book that we refer to for all of our wisdom is the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah, I think most of you in the room will be familiar with the Bhagavad Gita. It's an ancient classic, dated to about 5,000 years, a conversation which takes place between Krishna and Arjuna. And in 700 verses, Krishna really, I guess we could say, he gives the keys to life, the universe and everything. Krishna teaches everything from religion to relationships, science to sociology, leadership to life management. Krishna covers so many topics, and it becomes then really a reference point, almost like the handbook for life. as how to be successful and prosperous on every single level, physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually. And ultimately, the Bhagavad Gita is a book which allows us to then really connect spiritually and rediscover our deeper purpose, our deeper calling, rediscover our relationship with the Divine. And so the Bhagavad Gita is a very famous book, read by Einstein, Gandhi, Will Smith, which I don't know is the best thing to say right now, but anyway, we'll put it in there as well. Will Smith also said some years ago, he said, "I'm 90% through the Bhagavad Gita, and I'm now finding my inner Arjuna." Mm-hmm. So the Bhagavad Gita, it's interesting that he said that, because the Bhagavad Gita is not just a conversation you're reading between two people. When you look at Arjuna's questions to Krishna, and you look very closely, they're basically the questions that you will ask at some point in your life. And in that way, the Bhagavad Gita is not just a conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. The Bhagavad Gita is a conversation between Krishna and the soul. The Bhagavad Gita is a conversation between Krishna and you. And when you begin to read it, it's profound. But today, we're going to question, why should I read the Bhagavad Gita? And my friend here, Nritishekhar Prabhu, will play the part of a skeptic. We're going to have three debates. In the first debate, he's going to be an atheist. And he's going to try to deconstruct, why is it that I actually live my life by reading a book? A book that I'm not even sure is true. Later on, once I've defeated him, because I'm going to defeat him. if I manage to defeat him, or if I manage to satisfactorily answer his queries, then the next persona he's going to take on is the persona of a spiritual seeker. Because someone may say, yeah, I agree, there is something more to life, but there are many books in the world. There's the Torah, there's the Quran, there's the Hadiths, there's the Dharmapada. Why should I read the Bhagavad Gita? Amongst all the spiritual books, why do you focus just on this one book? What about all the books of the other spiritual traditions? So then I'll try to respond to some of his points. And then in the third debate, he's going to take on the role of someone who agrees that the Vedic literatures are the go-to place to understand the deepest spiritual truths. But he's going to ask me, why the Bhagavad Gita? Why not the Puranas? Why not the Upanishads? Why not Patanjali's Yoga Sutras? What makes the Bhagavad Gita so special amongst all the other Vedic literatures? And as we have these debates, please in your mind see whether any questions come up in your heart and mind. And then we'll also try to address some of them at the end. Does that sound okay?
Yes.
Are you excited?
Yes.
Okay. So, I'll hand over to my atheistic friend.
Yes. So, Maharaj. Maharaj? Could I call you Maharaj?
The Swami.
Oh, the Swami. All right. So, Mr. Swami. You're claiming that God exists? Is that a claim that you have? That God exists? I believe things I can see. You know? I can see you, I can see the Swami's here, isn't it? He's in front of me, we're interacting with him, we're communicating with him. You know, I can see that she sat there. You know? Everyone, our senses are engaged, we can tell that she sat there. But why is your focus so strongly built upon saying that God exists when we cannot see Him, when we cannot have that physical interaction with Him? Everything else is clear. But you strongly fixate your philosophy and your understanding on the fact that God exists, yet it's so difficult for us to see Him. We can't even see, you know, that He exists. So why am I supposed to believe that He exists?
By the way, there's a Specsavers in town if you need to get a eye checkup. okay, have you ever seen your brain? Have you ever seen your brain? A yes or no will do?
No.
Okay. Do you have a brain?
Yes.
How are you so sure?
Scientific.
According to your methodology, you're brainless because you can't see it. Have you ever been to Mexico?
No.
Do you believe Mexico exists?
Yes.
Why? You have never seen it. In life, there are so many things that we haven't seen. There are so many things that we haven't directly perceived by our own mind and senses. And that's quite natural, because our mind and senses are limited. Right now, can you see what's beyond that wall?
No.
Is there an existence beyond that wall?
Yes.
Yeah, but you can't see it, because your mind and senses are limited. So therefore, what we're saying is that God can be perceived, God can be seen, but maybe not by the methodology and the means that you've been trying to see everything in this world, because that methodology is limited. So our first point is that even you believe in the philosophy that we can believe things that we don't see, because I've already proved that to you. The second thing I'd like to share with you is a further point that actually you can see God. You can see God. Just because you haven't seen God, does that mean no one's seen God?
No.
Just because you've never been to Mexico, does that mean no one's been to Mexico? Exactly. So to make a statement that no one's seen God, that's a little bit presumptuous. You've not seen God. But there may be other people who have seen God. And our proposition is that you can see God, but then you have to do the experiment. Science means don't ask for the proof before doing the experiment. Do the experiment and then you get the proof. Is that okay?
Well, you know, the things that you mentioned, for example, Mexico and the brain, are things that in my immediate sense perception I can't be able to see or experience, but I can be able to get a strong idea of it. For example, a brain scan can be done and we can have this understanding. And the scientists are giving us this in a coherent way. You know, do you use medication? You utilize medication, isn't it? The scientists have created, you know, after understanding the body and how the physicality works, a system by which, you know, by certain use of certain things, we can get certain results. So even though I might not be able to directly see my brain, I can, in a coherent way, be able to perceive it, even in layman's terms. We normally say, you know, an intelligent person can explain the most complex thing to a child. So even for me, who's probably not being able to practice, surely, if God exists, and as you guys claim, He's connected with me, it should be very easy for me to have that exchange with Him. But you tell me that I have to go through this process, I have to dress like this, do I have to, you know, turn my life around like, you know, you seemingly have, as you earlier on explained, in order to get to perceive this God? Why is it such a complex thing if, you know, it's something that should be straightforward and direct for all of us?
Thank you so much, yes. Well, the first thing is we don't have a problem with science. You have, science has discovered things. We appreciate science. We appreciate the fact that there are doctors. We appreciate the fact that there are technologies that we can utilize. I also have an iPhone. It's only an iPhone 8 though. We appreciate this. But science has its realm of what it can answer and what it can decipher. And what we have a problem with is when science goes beyond its realm and claims to prove things which are beyond its jurisdiction. Where do you believe the world came from? Big Bang?
Yes.
Has science ever proved that? Has that moment of the singularity when all matter was concentrated at a single point and at a superheated temperature, it burst into a Big Bang and formed universes and galaxies? Has that ever been recreated within a lab?
No.
Has it? No. So we don't have a problem if you say we've created an electric toothbrush, or we've figured out a sat-nav system by which you can get from here to there. We appreciate it, we like it. But science has its realm. Science can make things better, but spirituality makes people better. By all the scientific discoveries of the world, has the world become a better place? Has the world become a happier place? We have taller buildings, but shorter tempers. We have wider highways, but narrower minds. We have more valuables, but less values. We buy more, but we enjoy less. We lose our health to get wealth, and then we spend that wealth to get the health back. We have more experts, but less solutions. We have more degrees, but less common sense. So science has advanced the world, and we appreciate that. But what we're saying is that science has its realm, and now if you factor in spirituality to work together with science, then we can have a much better world. There were many scientists who believed in God. Louis Pasteur, he said, "All I'm doing by all my scientific research is finding out how God did His work." So please don't create an aggressive demarcation between science and spirituality. They can go hand in hand, and they should go hand in hand, and they should answer the questions that they're qualified to answer. And science cannot answer questions of why we're here, why we exist, what happens after this life. That is beyond the realms of science. And therefore, we have to understand the limitations of science. And therefore, we go to the Bhagavad Gita. We go to the Bhagavad Gita, which is a higher dimensional source of information, to derive insights which our mind and senses cannot, in and of their own capacity, grasp.
Well, it makes a little bit of sense there, I must agree. You say we shouldn't have a negative, stance on the aspect of religion, but, as an atheist, I think I choose this stance solidly because of my experience or the things I've seen in this world with regards to God. Religion is there, the understanding of God is there, but I'm not seeing happier people because of this. I'm seeing actually the biggest wars that are existing in this world are to do with the concept of God. I look at where I'm from, colonization became quite successful because they use the principle of God to be able to manipulate the minds of my fellow Africans back at home. So how can I, it's very difficult for me to see anything positive coming out of it because a lot of these principles are things even for me as an atheist. Be good to others, be kind to others, take care of this world, leave it as better as you have found it, use the scientific means to make it improve. I feel like I have a much better life and viewpoint in comparison to that which religion is bringing because of all the negatives it's brought. So why should I turn to this God? And He's also not changing things. He's, COVID-19 hit. Those who believed in God also got sick. Those who believe in God also died. We were all on the same playing field and I'm an atheist. So how can I understand this?
There are parts of this world which are highly religious and parts of this world which are clearly secular, non-religious, atheistic. Isn't it? In the parts of this world where there is no religion, do you find that in those places people are all completely happy? In the places where there's no religion, do you find that there's absolutely no conflict? In the places where there's no religion, do you find that there's no crime, no pollution, no socio-anthropological issues? No. So you find these problems everywhere, religious or non-religious. Religions create war, and atheists also create war. Some of the biggest wars of this our modern history were caused by people who are not religious, and they were also caused by so-called religious people. So what we would say is that religion or spirituality, when it's used in its true sense, in the appropriate way, by individuals who have pure hearts and pure motivation, that religion and spirituality will bring about good in the world, and we see that happening. There will also be a certain percentage of people who will misuse religion, who will use religion in a way to divide, to cause friction, to invoke emotions within people because they have desires for land, money, power, influence, and they will misuse religion. But we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And therefore, rather than looking at every religious practitioner, one should look at sincere religious practitioners and see how their life has become beautiful and see what kind of beautiful impact they've had on the world by sharing genuine spirituality. And then you'll get a much more accurate picture about what religion actually does to make the world a better place.
Right.
Shall we stop there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, one more?
One more thing. This person had an experience. You know, they were in a plane and they were traveling, and the plane was obviously filled. It had, I think, around 80, 90 people. And then suddenly there was a malfunction, and then they got into an accident and the plane crashed. 89 people died and he was alive. And when he came back, he said it was a miracle. It was a miracle that he survived and, you know, and everyone else died. Now my question is, if this God is truly existing, you know, is it that God saved one and killed the rest? Or is it that he was trying to kill all of them and then one he missed? How do we understand this if this God is a person who's existing and is all loving and all caring? Is in that clear situation, this one person is alive, the rest have died, surely he's caused more harm than good. So how do we understand this? How does this make sense to us?
When you were small, did your parents do things that annoyed you, that angered you, that later on you realized were very good for you?
2 years.
Yeah, did that happen? Why do you think when you were a small kid you couldn't understand everything that your parents were doing, even though it was for your good? Why do you think that was?
I probably do not have a bigger picture.
Right. There's here are people who are more mature, who have a higher vision, who have a long-term strategy in place, and you are not not aware of that. And therefore, when we tend to look at the world, we look at the world with our limited vision. You said, why did 89 people die and only one survived? That statement in itself shows a lack of vision, because no one's ever born and no one ever dies. The soul is eternal. Even science says energy cannot be created or destroyed, but simply transferred from one place to another. So when you say 89 people died, immediately even science won't accept that, because life continues. This life is a chapter. This life is one chapter of a longer story. And therefore, when you try to begin to decipher the whole storyline of a book, simply by reading one chapter, you will necessarily be confused. Rather, what you should understand is that this is one chapter, there was a story before, there will be a story after. And therefore, what we're going through now must be nested within a bigger vision of the journey that the soul is on. The body may die, the mind may even experience pain, but the soul is never harmed. The soul moves on to another existence. Therefore, if you want to understand the depth of God's love, you have to understand the length and the breadth of your existence. The length of your existence means this life is one amongst many. And the breadth of your existence means you're not just this body, you're not just this mind, but your spiritual consciousness, which is driving and animating everything. Understand the breadth of your identity as body, mind, soul, and understand the length of your identity as more than just this one life. And when you understand the length and the breadth of your identity, then you will be able to understand the depth of God's love. There's some spiritual mathematics for you. Hare Krishna. I think give him a round of applause. He did amazing. So these are some of the questions people ask when it comes to science, spirituality. Sometimes people think the Bhagavad Gita is just something, a faith, something that you just believe in because of your culture. But actually the Bhagavad Gita is as scientific as anything we find in the world. And Srila Prabhupada, who spread the Krishna consciousness movement all over the world, He didn't present the Bhagavad Gita as a religious book, as the book of a particular culture or a particular ethnic tradition. He presented the Bhagavad Gita as spiritual science, a handbook for actually experiencing these things for yourself directly. And so these are some of the ways in which we can respond to some of these questions. Before we go on to our next debate, does anyone have any questions or any points they would like to ask about this, or maybe to further investigate anything that we talked about? Anyone would like to ask anything about science and spirituality, faith and doubt, how the Bhagavad Gita stands up in a logical, rational, philosophical way? Anyone? Don't worry, we won't start debating with you. Anyone? Yes, yes.
Could you maybe say your understanding of dharm? So, you know, dharm, usually people would say it's a religion, but I don't think the Gita kind of says that it's a religion.
Yeah.
Dharm is maybe a way of looking at things, I think.
Yeah.
And you know what you were saying about, oh, you know, these people died and one survived, so it doesn't make sense. So I don't know, I think, yeah, so I just want to know, I think dharm may explain it in the sense.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, so many of you may have heard of this word dharma. Dharma comes from the Sanskrit word dhri, D-H-R. Dhri means to hold or to sustain. So dharma literally means that which sustains each of us. Dharma literally means the essence of our being. Dharma can mean our purpose, our inner... our inner essence. It's a very difficult word to translate. Sometimes people translate dharma as religion, but that's actually somewhat of a superficial translation. I think the easiest way to understand dharma is it means the essence of one's being. The dharma of salt is to be salty. The dharma of sugar is to be sweet. The dharma of water is to be fluid. The dharma of fire is to burn. In other words, what is that one thing that's inseparable from the entity that is the entity's dharma? And so, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that the dharma of the soul is to love and to serve. If we're living in our life, but there's no one who we love, and there's no one who we therefore serve with our heart, then we are living as ghosts. Isn't it? Imagine tomorrow you would... something amazing would happen in your life. What's the first thing you do? You pick up the phone and you want to share it with someone. Imagine something amazing happened to you, but you had no one to share it with. Imagine you had everything under the sun, but you had no loving relationships with people. It would not satisfy the heart. Therefore, the dharma, the ultimate dharma, is to love. And religion is that thing which allows us to awaken the deepest type of love. We speak so much the word love in the world today, but most people don't even know what love is. I love orange juice. I love that movie. We use the word love so cheap. But love is actually the complete giving of oneself to someone else and that reciprocation. And so dharma means love, to love and to serve. And spirituality is the way, real way to find that dharma of how to love, how to serve in such a way that our heart becomes completely fulfilled. Because if you look at the world, it's a case of frustrated love. The whole world is frustrated love. Last Christmas, I gave you my heart, and the very next day, you threw it away. Isn't it? All these songs are there. Love songs. All love, frustrated love. So dharma means to find love, to serve, in the deepest way possible and then attain the deepest satisfaction. You want to add anything to that?
No, I think here you the way you placed it is just so accurate. There's nothing much more to add. It's our natural tendency. I always tell people, you know, when you come to the temple and you see the deities, some of the deities that form their hand is naturally out like that. And we normally describe that they're in the mood of service. And then we give this example of, you can cook. Yes, some of you can cook, I can cook a little bit. When I cook for myself, it's nice. But then when I cook for others, even before I've eaten, and I can watch them eat, and there's a satisfaction that you receive naturally. That's very rewarding, that's very comforting. And so then it makes sense that our natural propensity is to have that kind of satisfaction of serving others, and it's very rewarding being in that stage where we just serve others and give our hearts in that way without thinking about our own enjoyment, but enjoying through their satisfaction and through, obviously, with the divine satisfaction like that. That's what I'd add, maybe on top of that.
Anyone else? Yeah, there's a question at the back. Yeah.
You're making the point that science makes things better, but spirituality makes people better. Is that not a bit of an egotistical thing to say, that only spirituality can make people better, when there are so many people who have good qualities who don't follow a particular spiritual path?
Yeah, good question. Want to answer that?
Sure.
Okay, so isn't it a bit egotistical statement to say that science makes things better, spirituality makes people better? To really make something better means to make something better in a way that's deep and sustainable. Okay, understand this point. To really make something better means to transform that thing on the deepest level. And because you've transformed it on the deepest level, that change and that improvement is sustainable. Okay? If you have a boil and I just blow on it and it makes you feel better, have I really made you better? No, I've just given you some temporary relief. And that's, we do that, that's good, but it hasn't really made you better. The reason we say science makes things better and spirituality makes people better is because science, if it's devoid, and here I mean science which is devoid of a spiritual perspective, because as I said, there are many scientists who factor in spirituality, but when we take spirituality out of science and it becomes mechanistic science, then that kind of science is simply dealing with the external coverings of the soul, and therefore it's not working on the soul itself. And because it's not working on the soul, it cannot really do anything to unlock the innate goodness and divinity which is within us. Science may help us to organize our communities better, to have some level of cooperation and regulated exchanges so that social intercourse is done in a moral and cultural way. Yeah, that can be done, but such things break down. Therefore, we see societies break down, civilizations break down, because there's not a deep spiritual thing which is sustaining those qualities. Even the person in this world who has the best qualities, eventually there will be times when they fall prey to their lower nature because they haven't been transformed on the deepest level. So we're not going to stand here and say people who are not spiritual don't have any good qualities. We see people who have good qualities, but what we will say is that if you want those qualities to be imbibed in the deepest way, in a sustainable way, then those qualities have to be generated through deep spiritual transformation beyond the body and mind. And that's why we say science, because it only deals with superficial coverings, it can only help people in a temporary way. But the soul is where the work needs to be done. Is that okay? You can challenge me further if you like.
Mm-hmm.
No? Shall we move on to the next debate? Is this good? Is this useful?
Yes.
It's insightful, yeah? Okay. So you introduce to us who you are and what your question.
Alright, yes, yeah, so I'm Nitya, a little bit more of a spiritual seeker right now. So I feel that maybe you guys have a little bit more answers than what I initially had thought. Is your claim or your exclamation that there's only one God, is that something that you believe in, that spirituality preaches, that there's only one God?
Yes.
Yes, okay. But my question is, then why are there so many varieties of religions and all these different practices? Surely if God is one, he could make one easy, you know, simple process to get to him. But we have so many different religions. Some of them we don't get access to till way later in life. Some of them we are born in and we find, you know, difficult to understand. Some places we are born without it. And there's so many sources of ways to connect with God. So how are we supposed to understand this if God is just one?
Everyone understood the question? God is one, but theology is complex. Because although God is one, God is also complex in his identity, and we are also complex in our mentality. And therefore, God has to create complex theology in order to awaken true spirituality within individuals. And I'll explain what I mean. There's one God, but that God appears in many, many different places, in many, many different forms, in many, many different traditions, using many, many different names. God cannot be limited, just like you're one person, but you connect with so many different people and they all know a different aspect of your character. You have different relationships with people and therefore they see you in different ways. So similarly, if we can have so many aspects to our personality, why can't God? God has so many aspects. For some, God is the controller. For some, God is the impersonal energy. For some, God is the friend who's within the heart. And for some, God is the charming person who just captures their heart by his beauty and his mesmerizing personality. All of them are God. And different religions, what they do is they approach different aspects of God's character. Whether you worship Allah, whether you worship Jehovah, whether you worship Krishna, these are all the one God, but known in different ways, in different traditions, through different rituals. And because we all have many different desires, some of us approach God out of fear. Some of us approach God because we want something material. Some of us approach God because we want answers. And some of us approach God because we really want to love Him. And therefore what God does is He creates different religious systems which fulfill all of these aspirations that we have in such a way that whether you're fearing God, whether you're asking God for something, whether you want answers, whether you want to love Him, there's a religious system for you to plug into so that you can elevate yourself up that spiritual ladder and then connect with God in the deepest way. So there's one religion, there's one God who has many personalities, and that one God who has many personalities creates many different religious systems in order to give the many different people who have many different desires an opportunity to connect spiritually, and in that way there is unity in diversity between all the religions.
Alright, that makes a little bit of sense. But then I wonder, you know, I would then prefer to see you in a much more neutral way, you know, not just presenting the Bhagavad Gita, but presenting all the different scriptures, the Bible, the Torah, the Quran, like this. But you present this one aspect of God in as a fundamental way of connecting. If they're all supposed to be, you know, leading us towards the same direction, then why an emphasis or a push on this Bhagavad Gita of yours or these teachings that you follow? Like that.
Does the Torah tell you that there's a world beyond this world?
Ooh, I'm not too sure.
Just say yes.
Yes, good.
Does the Quran tell you that if you chant God's names, then you will come closer to God?
Yes.
Does the Bible tell you that if you are kind to others and develop saintly character, then that will increase your sense of spirituality? Does the Dharmapada tell you that by, you know, doing meditation and certain disciplines of spiritual practice, that you reawaken a higher consciousness? Therefore, what we are teaching is universal. We are also teaching the Bible. We are also teaching the Quran, because all of the principles of these scriptures are the same. The reason that we focus on the Bhagavad Gita is because although every religion is the same in the sense of its universal principles, there is also a hierarchy in terms of how much detail each religion has about the spiritual reality. Just like you can have a pocket dictionary and you can have the Cambridge dictionary. And both are true, both are correct, both are completely useful. Yet there is a difference in the detail that each one has. So the reason that we follow the Vedic literatures, the Vedic tradition, the reason why we stress the Bhagavad Gita is because the level of insight that you get from that tradition in terms of the nature of God, the nature of the world, and the nature of the soul, that level of detail and scientific analytical explanation you will not be able to find anywhere else. That doesn't mean that other religions are not good. That doesn't mean that other religions are not useful. But when we do a comparative study, then we'll be able to see that the level of detail that you find in this tradition, in this theology, surpasses that of other theologies. And therefore, that's why we speak from the Bhagavad Gita. But we're not in opposition to any other religion.
Well, but this Bhagavad Gita you speak of, you know, like I went to the shop and I saw there's hundreds of different versions of this Bhagavad Gita. I think there's more than 600 versions of this Bhagavad Gita. And some of them are not giving the same conclusion as this Bhagavad Gita that you probably... I think the one that you carry is written there, Bhagavad Gita as it is. So, you know, how am I sure that the way you present it is how it is when there's 600 other versions of this Bhagavad Gita and they're all drawing something that, you know, is fundamental for them from the same scriptures? How do I rely on, as a spiritual speaker, as a spiritual seeker, how do I rely on the knowledge that's coming from this as it is Bhagavad Gita?
Well, anything in this world is up for interpretation. And we'll agree with you by saying that not every single translation of the Bhagavad Gita is necessarily authentic. So we agree with you. There are also translations of the Bhagavad Gita which may not be true to the text. That's a reality. Now then your next question will be, how do I separate the saints from the swindlers? How do I actually then find the authentic one? In everything in this world, there are reals and there are fakes. There is a real Polo Ralph Lauren and there's a fake. There's a real Coca-Cola and there's a fake. Right? There's a real and a fake of everything in this world. So there's also a real and fake of the Bhagavad Gita. So the real question then is that how do I identify the real? The reason why we talk about this Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, as Bhagavad Gita as it is because Srila Prabhupada's translation is so authentic that it has the original Sanskrit, it has word for word translations of every single Sanskrit word, it has the English translation, and it has a commentary based on what the teachers of the past have commented. and therefore is completely transparent, is completely in tradition, it's presented without any personal motivations, and therefore we say it's the Bhagavad Gita as it is. Now you may say, I'm a new guy, how do I know what this Sanskrit word is, whether it's actually authentic, how do I know? So then the ultimate way that you'll know that this is the Bhagavad Gita as it is if you live it and if you practice it. So you have to try. The ultimate proof of the pudding is in the tasting. So I can give you linguistic arguments, philosophical arguments, why this translation of the Bhagavad Gita is the most authentic, but I don't think that will satisfy you. The real thing that's going to satisfy you is if you live it, if you practice it, and if you see it working within your own consciousness, then you will know this is true. And therefore we invite you. You've tried so many things in your life, so why not now try the Bhagavad Gita? It's beneficial, it's offering you a benefit of unlimited happiness. It's probable, there's a good chance that it will work because millions of people in the past have revered this scripture and testify to having spiritual experience through practicing the scripture. So it's beneficial, it's probable, and it's practical. You can start this experiment without making major changes to your life. You don't need to change your dress, you don't need to change your hairstyle, you don't need to change any of your external culture, just read the philosophy and practice the spiritual process and see what happens. If something is beneficial, probable and practical, you'd be a fool not to at least try it. You'd be a fool to dismiss it without trying it. So give it a try. Hare Krishna. And give a round of applause. Okay, so here we kind of discussed different religions and why the Bhagavad Gita or why the Vedic tradition stands out amongst those traditions. Does anyone have any questions on this aspect of the discussion?
Yes.
So you spoke about God is one, right? And there are different religions. And what I'm curious about is, yes, God is one and there are many religions, and many religions do follow different gods. And where do you think the narrative has gone wrong for over centuries, where people believe that their God is the only God and try to influence other religions and try to believe that what they follow is the right way and their God is the only God, and that's the one God that the world has to believe in? And where do you think this narrative has gone wrong over the years? And this has been coming from the priest or monks, from their religions, from the top bottom. And since it's coming from top, and like people also believe in what their spiritual masters of those religions talk about. So how and what's your perspective or take on this? And like, what do you think about this?
Yeah. Scholars of religion say that religious scripture is susceptible to three things: interpolation, extrapolation, and displacement. Interpolation means scripture is subject to the threat that someone could insert something that wasn't there in the original. Extrapolation means scripture is susceptible to the fact that people may take things out that was originally there. And displacement means that scripture is susceptible to the defect that perhaps things can be reordered or kind of hierarchized in a different way to what was originally meant. And therefore we find that many religions have this problem, that what they read today is not necessarily, or what they're taught today in the name of that religion is not necessarily the authentic presentation of that theological path. So that threat is there, and we see that. And therefore, for example, in the Christian tradition, we hear the statement in the book of John that Christ is the truth, the way, and the light, and no one can reach the Father except through Him. And so we often find this quoted by those of that faith to say that you have to practice Christianity and you can't practice it. Religious scholars have actually questioned the authenticity of whether that statement was made and the authenticity of the Book of John in making that statement. So one reason we can find that this narrative has come about is because of interpolation, extrapolation, and displacement of theological literature. That's one thing. But here's another thing. Sometimes in a tradition, that may well be written. But you will say, why will God say that there's only one God and all the other religions are wrong when He's the one making all the other religions? Why would He say that? He may say that in a specific religious tradition because for the people of that time, it may be a necessary message to tell them, just focus on this one thing and do this one thing. Don't divert your attention anywhere else in order to give them a certain focus that's required at this part of their spiritual evolution for them to make progress. Just like when I went to university, I went into an economics class. And the lecturer, I remember at the beginning of the term, pulled up a textbook and said, this is the textbook and I want you to only read this textbook. And I thought, like, does that mean every other economics textbook is wrong? No. But the lecturer knows, I'm teaching in a specific way and I want you to follow this textbook and this textbook only, because if you read the other ones, the pedagogy is different and you may get confused. And therefore, just focus on this one path, not to say that everything else is wrong, but it's beneficial for you in your stage of learning. So some theologies may say that they're the only way, that there's only one God. And that statement is a statement which is made according to time, place, and circumstance for the benefit of the people of that time. But it's not an eternal statement which stands in all times, places, and circumstances. Just like in maths, when you're doing maths in the beginning, and then if someone comes and says, what's 5 minus 10? In the beginning, they'll say, no, that's not possible. 5 minus 10 is not possible. 10 minus 5 is possible. Because in that stage of learning maths, we don't talk about minus numbers. You'll get confused. So first, just learn that 10 minus 5 is 5. Learn that 10 minus 7 is 3. Learn that 10 minus 8 is 2. And when you have your basic understanding of maths, then we can now add a layer and say, you know what? There's more to the story. There are also minus numbers. So that 5 minus 10 is minus 5. But if you try to teach someone that immediately, they'll get confused. And therefore some religions, what they do is they say, just follow this, in order to help practitioners build a certain basis of understanding, and then much more can be said later. Therefore Christ said, I have much more to tell you, but your ears cannot bear it at this point. Is that Christ or Muhammad?
No, that's Christ.
That's Christ. Understand? So one is it could be that scriptures have changed, and the other is that it could just be the pedagogy of how that theology is being taught. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyone else like to ask anything on this? Yes?
So does that mean that every religion will get everyone to the same destination, which is like the highest, like, relationship with God?
Does that mean every religion will end up in the same destination, which is a relationship with God in the spiritual world? You see, it's not so much about what religion you practice, but it's about how much love you awaken, the purity of your love. You see, someone can have access to the most detailed spiritual literatures, but they can interface with them in an extremely superficial way and not really develop love. And similarly, someone can have very limited knowledge of God, but because of their high sincerity, they can develop very, very elevated states of love. It's not so much about the religion, but it's about how much you use it. See? Like, say for example, okay, here's my phone here, yeah? So this is my phone. So I could use this as a doorstopper. And it will work, won't it? It will work, it will do the job. I'm using it. I'm using my iPhone as a doorstopper, and it's helping me. But if I do that, you'll think I'm pretty crazy, because it might do the job, but you can do something much better with it. So the point is not so much that I got this, but now what am I going to do with it? So what determines where someone goes after this life is not their religious affiliation, is how much pure love that they have within their heart. There's a difference between loving God and liking God. Most people think they love God, but actually they like God. Buddha said, what's the difference between loving and liking? He said, you see that flower over there? If you like it, you'll go over to it, you'll pick it, you'll smell it, and then you'll leave it to one side. But if you love it, then you'll go over to that flower, you'll water it, you'll protect it, and you'll nourish it. When we go to God, are we asking? Are we expecting? Are we demanding? Are we praying? Give me a house by the sea, a color TV, a 15 gigabyte MP3? Or are we going to God and saying, what can I do for you? How can I serve you? What can I do in my life to please you? That's love. So whoever has that kind of love, they attain the highest destination, whether they be Hindu, Muslim, Christian. It depends on the quality of their love.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, just based on that, because that's one thing I always used to think about. One person had sent me this, something small, which I'd like to share, which was this lady. She was, her name was Saint Teresa. And she was, I think she was from the ancient Catholic Church. And, you know, her mood was obviously not about the religion, but about actually developing love. And then in that, she shared something. So I'll just read it, something very short from this. It's a long statement, but I'll just read for you what her vision was. And this was in 1582, when she had written this, in 1582. So she says, I saw there, in this Eliseus, a young black man with a strange beauty. On top of his head he had like a garland that no crown of great quarry can have, and many bridesmaids that walked there with him with bouquets on hands, all in chants of praises of him. I was not doing but opening my eyes so I wouldn't be distracted and could not take my attention from it. So this is Saint Teresa, she's, you know, from the Catholic faith. In 1582, deepening her relationship with God and having that sincerity to love the Lord and serve the Lord. And yet her vision, in many ways, is clear with some of the things that we learn in the teachings that we're connected with. So it just emphasizes that point that it's not really about the path that you choose, it's the sincerity. And that's also what Krishna says in the Gita, to the extent with which you serve me, I'll give you the intelligence, I'll give you the vision to get that clarity. So just thought I'd add that.
How are we doing for time?
We'll take a couple more questions.
Yeah, so maybe we leave the third debate and we'll just take any questions that you may have, if you have any questions on any of these points, on the Bhagavad Gita, why we practice. Yes, Prabhu?
I have a question then, and so I heard that we are not trying to convince them to that our faith is the best and or better or something like that. But how to deal with this situation, like when I know the truth is something different than what he says.
So how to deal with other faiths when we feel like we want to share with them maybe a broader perspective. At the same time, we want to honor what they're doing. Of course, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he says, when I go into a church, then I see that here is my same God being worshipped in a different way, with different words, through different rituals. So the first thing we should understand is that everyone is a sincere seeker looking for God. George Harrison said, everyone is looking for Krishna. Some know it, some don't. So everyone's looking for God. We grew up with a certain path with a certain theology that was kind of instilled within us. And sometimes that creates a deep impression. Sometimes it creates also an attachment that stops us from seeing things logically. Therefore, when we're speaking to individuals, how much we reveal of the, or how much we share with them of the broader spiritual perspective, the deeper truths that may be there, how much we share with them the bigger picture of theology beyond what they may be aware of, that very much depends on their openness. You see? We can give so much information to people, but the question is, how open is that person to dialogue and to learning? And therefore, what is one of the most important things when teaching is, don't give people more than they can digest, isn't it? Just like you can put so much food in your mouth, but if you don't chew it and swallow it and digest it, all of that food, it won't. So similarly, like we just look at the openness, the hunger, the desire for someone to know. What we try to do is spark their interest, inspire their heart through sharing certain things. And over time, when people become more inquisitive, more desirous, then we can share more. So in answer to your question, I would say there's no stereotyped way of doing it. Just be people's well-wisher. You see, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So when people see that you're their genuine well-wisher, that you really want to help them, then their heart will be open to hear from you. And then you can share with them in a compassionate mood, not trying to defeat them, not trying to be better than them, but in a mood that genuinely, I want to help you in your spiritual path. And then people will be very happy to accept. Is that okay?
Yeah.